Okay, so Jonah chapter 4, I would summarize this little section here as really the sin of conservatism. Now, by saying that, I don't make any allusion to political parties or political movements, but rather conservatism as it just is. Well, verse 1, it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he was angry. Jonah wanted to see Nineveh's destruction. Well, he had died, it seems to me, in the sea, and then he was swallowed by the great creature that God had created. He says in his psalm that he went down into Sheol, into the grave, and then he was spat out again. He resurrected. And Jesus says that as Jonah was 3 days and three nights inside the belly of the whale, so he would be in the heart of the earth, implying that his resurrection was after the pattern of Jonah's. So he'd been shown amazing grace. He really had been. And you would expect him to have walked humbly all his days after that, but he doesn't. He still has his anger, his elitism, his conservatism, his pride and prejudice. Now, if ever you need a lesson in the strength of pride and prejudice, in the strength of elitism, in the strength of conservative thinking, well, it is in Jonah. Judgmentalism, elitism dies a very hard death, and some people never quite get there, I'm afraid. And yet, for Jonah, I think he did get there, and I think that this book, this wonderful book, that's written, okay, by inspiration of God, but all the same, also by Jonah, I think it's him looking back on his life and saying, what an ungracious person I was, what a terrible bloke I was, how up myself I was, what a harsh redneck I was, and how wrong I was. So he was angry that they'd repented. Well, God was rejoicing. You know, Jesus said in Matthew 12 that there will be the men of Nineveh who will rise in the day of judgment and be saved, whereas the self-righteous, hyper-religious Jews of his generation would not be. So there was joy in heaven over the repentance of these people. Thousands of them apparently repented. There was joy in heaven, but on earth, God's preacher, Jonah, is bitterly angry. He's certainly out of step with the Spirit. And you think of the Lord's words, is your eye evil because I am good? That is, are you clouded by a mean-spirited outlook on life because of my grace? And so often, that is what happens. I can remember baptizing large numbers of people and coming back to the community that I was associated with and saying, yeah, you know, I baptized 20 people or 30 people out in some point in Africa or Pakistan or wherever it was, Eastern Europe. And the seething anger just could not be hidden, that elitism. And the questions, well, you know, are they all married? Have they all got marriage certificates? Do they know the truth? Have they really repented? Are they sincere? Are they just rice Christians? Are they just looking for money? Those sort of questions. This is the story of Jonah, I'm afraid. So then, Jonah just didn't want Nineveh to repent. That was his mission, but he didn't want that. And I have suggested earlier that the sailors who did cry out to God, to Yahweh, and turned to Yahweh, were in fact from Nineveh, and it was them who had told people the wonderful thing that had happened. And so Jonah himself was the living proof that if you are under a death sentence, as he was, and you cry out to God, he will save you. He was the message, really, that God's grace is real, even though he was so bitter. He had not responded to it. So in fact, his bitterness and crankiness was in fact almost an encouragement to the Ninevites, if you think about it. That look, if you cry to God, he will save you. He really will. But okay, this guy isn't appreciative. What an unpleasant, unappreciative, ungracious bloke this fella is. Let us not be like him. Let us believe in this wonderful God and his grace. Let's not be like this fella. Let's actually respond. And that's what they did. And God heard that. It was amazing how God worked through it all. So Jonah comes over as the hyper-conservative. And I said that this whole narrative is really about what I call the sin of conservatism. Jesus recognized that in Luke 5 when he said that people prefer the old wine. Even if the new wine is better, they will say, no, the old was better. And he's criticizing then this basic tendency within human beings to assume that the past is better. And again, in Ecclesiastes, you have that referenced, that don't say the former days are better than these. That is a tendency to assume that the past was better, and today is not so good, and tomorrow is going to be worse. Whereas for the people of God, it should be the other way round. The past was awful. Today is a lot better, thanks to God's grace, and tomorrow is an eternal tomorrow of God's wonderful kingdom that I'm looking forward to. So remember that it was hardline, hardcore religious conservatism rather than liberalism which resulted in the hatred, persecution, and crucifixion of the Son of God. This was why Israel killed their king, killed the Son of God. And there was probably no generation ever in the whole history of Israel who were more technically obedient to God's law and who were more into being Jewish on a fairly wide scale than Palestine in the first century. And they were the ones who crucified Jesus. And then you come to the preaching of the gospel and the Acts of the Apostles, and you see all the wrangling that there was by the Jewish Christians over this issue of Gentiles. Should Gentiles be baptized? Should we fellowship with Gentiles? Should we break bread with them? Even Peter fell away to this sort of reasoning for a bit and wouldn't break bread with the Gentile brethren, the whole demand that they be circumcised and all that. And so much of the New Testament is taken up with this very sad story. And again, it is the conservative attitudes which are shown to be so wrong. When you look at the spirit of Jesus and you remember that Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever, who were the group that he was really angry with and condemned in the toughest language? Was it the liberals who couldn't really morally act as they should, you know, the prostitutes, the tax collectors? Or was it with the hyper-conservative religious types? Without any question, it was with the hyper-conservative religious types. They were the ones that really he was so angry with, and there is so much material in the Gospels about them. This was obviously a major thing with him. And he says in verse 2, he says, "Please, Yahweh, wasn't this what I said when I was still in my own country? Therefore I hurried to flee away to Tarshish, for I knew that you are a gracious God, and merciful, slow to anger, and abundant in loving kindness, and you relent of doing harm." Well, he's actually quoting, consciously or unconsciously, God's own revelation of his character and name to Moses in Exodus 32. And Jonah's effectively saying that he can't stand who God really is. He's focused on a few issues, like God's judgment of sin, and that's all he wants to see of God. So he's like a lot of religious people. He focuses on a few aspects of God, God's anger with sin and his judgment of it, and he builds his whole narrative of his understanding of God upon that, rather than seeing the wider picture of who God essentially is. And, you know, unfortunately you see this in so many people. People who maybe naturally are wired to be exclusivist, judgmental, elitist, xenophobic, and they grab hold of a few statements about God and, oh, that's it. You know, I am upholding God's truth upon the earth. Rather than seeing that the essence of God is, I am a gracious God, very merciful, very slow to anger, and abundant in mercy and truth. And he quotes this about God and pretty well, maybe unconsciously, but he says, yeah, well, this is what I said. This is typical of you. Well, he who is so apparently committed to the holiness of Yahweh is actually missing the point of who Yahweh essentially is. So he sat on the east of the city, and made himself a shelter or a booth. It's the same word used about the booths that Israel were to make at the time of the Feast of Tabernacles. And they were supposed to sit underneath those booths or shelters and rejoice, and to also, at the Feast of Tabernacles, be generous to Gentiles. And the Gentile who was amongst them was to rejoice with them at that time. And I wondered if it was that time of year, if it was in fact the time of the Feast of Tabernacles. Well, anyway, he makes his booth and he sits under it sulking and angry and not joyful and not wanting any Gentiles near him. So, again, it's like him focusing on a couple of aspects of God's character but missing the obvious relevance of the vast majority of them. It's the same here with him thinking he's keeping his Feast of Tabernacles, well, yeah, but without any joy and with anger. Okay, verse 7. God prepared a worm, and it chewed on the vine that God had kindly made to grow up over Jonah, and it withered. You know, from great big fish to tiny worms, God is at work. So then, I think this little incident was to show to him how much God valued Nineveh. Because in chapter 4, verses 10 and 11, in the Hebrew, it says that God had made each of the Ninevites to grow. And it's the same word used about how this vine or gourd had grown, thanks to God, in verse 6. So God had made the Ninevites grow, and he'd made this vine or gourd grow up as a shade over Jonah. Jonah was grateful for the gourd and he valued it. But that was to show him God's value of Nineveh. And so Jonah was angry with the worm who'd made his vine or gourd perish. Now, the perishing of Nineveh and the perishing of the vine are clearly in parallel. It's the same word used, Jonah 3 verse 9, the perishing of Nineveh, that we do not perish, the Ninevites said, and the vine or the gourd perished here in chapter 4, verse 10. So the upshot of all this really is to realise that he was the worm. He was just a little worm. He, who thought he was the mighty legalist upholding God's truth on the earth, was no better than this little worm who had caused this wonderful part of God's creation, this vine, this gourd, to perish. And by not preaching to Nineveh, that is what he would have done. To Nineveh, he would have caused them all to perish. God says that he had great pity for Nineveh. And just in the same way as Jonah had pity for this gourd or this vine. And so God is saying, look, I have pity. I am full of pity for those people. There were so many of them. That's why Jonah is told at the start, go and preach to Nineveh, that great city. There's so many people there. Have a heart that bleeds for humanity. And Jonah replies, it's better for me to die than to live. And he's actually quoting the words of Elijah, as if, well, Elijah said this, so I must be right. But when Elijah says that, this is, again, the reason for Elijah being rejected by God as his prophet. He considered that he was the only faithful in Israel. And God says to him, look, there's 7,000 who haven't bowed the knee to Baal. And yet Elijah had said, I only am left. I'm the only one. So, Jonah thinks he can quote Elijah to sort of justify himself, but actually he's quoting a guy who's also suffering from the same problem of elitism, self-righteousness, etc., and who was pretty much condemned for doing so. So, this wonderful little story, and it's a true story, is really the classic warning against this spirit of religious conservatism becoming the narrative of human life, and the tendency, despite seeing so much of God's grace to yourself, as Jonah saw in the salvation that he experienced from the sea, despite all that grace, the tendency to return to legalism, to anger, the self-righteous condemnation of others is so strong. So we live in an age where anger is all around us. Condemnation of others is so much part of our daily experience. And elitism, judgmentalism is very much alive. It really is. And it's alive because, unfortunately, it is a strong tendency of our nature. But we don't have to give into it. We can overcome it. And I do think, as I have said all the way through, that this is Jonah writing this. And he doesn't sort of conclude by saying, well, learn the lesson from me, because he doesn't have to. It's sort of obvious. And he that is wise will perceive that.